Republicans win a surprise in Kentucky, Democrats keep their streak alive in Philadelphia, and we keep Neil Conan. A win-win-win on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. With another Republican debate coming up next week, who'll be the target, Hillary Clinton or the media?
Particularly in that CNBC debate, some of the questioners, there was a suggestion it was more about them than it was about the candidates. But boy, I don't envy them in trying to herd nine guys in Carly Fiorina.
Plus, Donald Trump becomes the latest politician to appear on Saturday Night Live. Is there a risk for him?
As we've seen, he's been able to say incredibly incendiary things without paying a price in the polls. So it's hard to imagine what exactly a fail for Donald Trump would look like, at least in the eyes of the electorate that's currently supporting him.
And we go back 50 years to one of the most memorable mayoral elections in the nation's history.
Lindsay showed you could lose by winning, and Buckley showed you could win by losing. They had different targets. Buckley was not out to be president of the United States, as John Lindsay was.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 101 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Tuesday was Election Day. It wasn't one that kept political junkies up late for clues or signs, but there are some results worth reporting. First of all, Republicans hardly ever win the governorship in Kentucky. They've done it only twice in the past 60 years or so, but they did so on Tuesday. Businessman Matt Bevin, a Tea Party favorite, defeated State Attorney General Jack Conway.
I'm humbled by the challenge before us. I'm humbled by the opportunity before us. I'm grateful for the fact that you have been so generous with your support to so many others who have run as well from the conservative side of the aisle. And I'll tell you, while I'm a Republican, and I've always been a Republican, and I'm proud for the fact that this is a great night for the Republican Party in the state of Kentucky.
Bevin had challenged Senator Mitch McConnell in last year's GOP primary, and after he lost in a landslide, he refused to endorse the winner. So the way I saw it was that the Republican Party had its divisions, while the Democrats and term-limited Governor Steve Beshear were all united behind Conway. Well, I was wrong. Bevin won, and won comfortably. What the result means for Beshear's Kinect insurance exchange program is the big question. There was no suspense in Mississippi. Republican Governor Phil Bryant easily disposed of his Democratic challenger, Robert Gray, a little-known truck driver who had no money and no organization. Not much suspense in the mayoral elections either. In Philadelphia, where Mayor Michael Nutter was barred from seeking a third term, the winner was former councilmember Jim Kenney. Democrats keep the post, but it ends 16 years of African-American mayors in the city of brotherly love. In San Francisco, Mayor Ed Lee easily defeated his five challengers to win re-election. Former state lawmaker Jackie Biscupsy becomes Salt Lake City's first openly gay mayor, defeating two-term incumbent Ralph Becker. Both are Democrats. In Houston, the race to succeed term-limited Mayor Anise Parker is headed to a December runoff, but a ballot measure that would prohibit discrimination against gays and transgender people, known as HERO, was overwhelmingly defeated. In Virginia, it was a clean sweep for the GOP. Republicans, as expected, kept their overwhelming advantage in the House. The focus was on the Senate, where Republicans had a two-seat majority, a majority that they will keep. A big defeat for Governor Terry McAuliffe. In Ohio, voters defeated a measure that would legalize marijuana for recreational purposes. The controversy there was less about pot and more about who would benefit from its legalization. That's what killed it. And in Tacoma, Washington, voters approved an increase in the minimum wage to $12 over 2 years. That, of course, leads to the trivia question. Last week, new House Speaker Paul Ryan was sworn into office by Michigan Democrat John Conyers, who is the most senior member of Congress. This week's question is, What was the national minimum wage when Conyers was first elected? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. It was more than a week ago when Republicans held their third debate, one where the candidates let loose against the CNBC moderators for what they perceived as biased and mean-spirited questions. Here was Ted Cruz.
You know, let me say something at the outset. The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media. This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions, Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
There was this exchange between one of the moderators and Marco Rubio.
So when the Sun Sentinel says Rubio should resign, not rip us off, when they say Floridian sent you to Washington to do a job, when they say you act like you hate your job, do you?
Yeah, let me say, I read that editorial today with a great amusement. It's actually evidence of the bias that exists in the American media today.
But do you hate your job?
Let me answer your question on the Sun Sentinel editorial today. Back in 2004, one of my predecessors to the Senate by the name of Bob Graham, a Democrat, ran for president, missing over 30% of his votes. I don't recall them calling for his resignation.
Is that the standard?
Later that year, in 2004, John Kerry ran for president, missing close to 60 to 70% of his votes. I don't recall the Sun Sentinel. In fact, the Sun Sentinel endorsed him. In 2008, Barack Obama missed 60 or 70% of his votes, and the same newspaper endorsed him again. So this is another example of the double standard that exists in this country between the mainstream media and the conservative media.
And Chris Christie couldn't believe it when there was a question about fantasy football.
Wait a second. We have $19 trillion in debt. We have people out of work. We have ISIS and Al-Qaeda attacking us. And we're talking about fantasy football?
Can we stop? Can we stop?
But the current Republican anger at the media has spread to their own party and the party chairman, Reince Priebus. The candidates claim the RNC has not protected them with the existing format. Meanwhile, we have two debates coming up next week, another Republican one, their fourth, on Tuesday, and a Democratic debate, only their second, on Saturday the 14th. It's the perfect time for Neil Conan to make his monthly visit to the Political Junkie. Neil is a news analyst at Hawaii Public Radio and the former host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. Neil, welcome back.
I'm not raising my hand, Ken. Don't ask me.
You're right. That's one of the rules. They don't want hand raising. They don't want yes or no questions. But you know something? The argument that we've heard from both parties, but especially Republicans, about media bias, I mean, that goes back a long way.
Sure. It goes back to, in my recollection, Spiro Agnew and the nattering nabobs of negativism. That was, of course, during the run-up to the Watergate crisis, and the nattering nabobs pretty much had it right. But it goes back to that whole feeling of we are somehow being attacked by the media, that they are out to get us, and it's us and them. You know, you get that bubble in the White House, you get it in a campaign, and, you know, sometimes they're right. But when, for example, the question to Ben Carson about, essentially, are you a shill for a snake oil? And he said, denied it, and it turned out that he was a shill for snake oil.
Yeah, I see. He said the questions were propaganda, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the question was, so you know something, one person's bias could be another person's probing questions.
Absolutely. Gotcha. It sometimes turns out to be a telling thing. Sometimes it turns out to be petty. The difference is sometimes, and particularly in that CNBC debate, some of the questioners seemed to be, there was a suggestion it was more about them than it was about the candidates. But boy, I don't envy them in trying to, you know, herd nine guys and Carly Fiorina.
Well, you mentioned that your memory goes back to Spiro Agnew. Let me bring you back a little further.
But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference. And I hope that what I have said today will at least make television, radio, the press recognize that they have a right and a responsibility, that if they're against a candidate, give him the shaft. But also recognize if they give him the shaft, put one lonely reporter on the campaign who will report what the candidate says now and then. Thank you, gentlemen, and good day.
You remember that one, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is, of course, the great paranoid of American presidential history. That's Richard Nixon. His paranoia did not prevent him from holding more news conferences, did it, Ken?
Right. Whatever happened to him?
I don't know.
Do the Republicans have a point, though? I mean, you know, they make the argument that, well, you know, the Democrats got softball questions, although I don't think Jim Webb thinks he got a softball question. I don't think that Bernie Sanders, the fact that he honeymooned in the Soviet Union, I don't think he thought that was a softball question. But they think that the questions directed at them, the Republicans, are far more nasty and pointed than what the Democrats get.
I think, A, that's a good talking point. It plays well to their base, the listeners to Rush Limbaugh and conservative radio, the people who watch Fox News. This plays very well into that whole narrative. You know, I have a theory, Ken, that there is no group too large, too wealthy, or too powerful not to consider themselves an oppressed minority.
Exactly.
And don't you think that this is also a function of if you're losing, it's because everybody's out to get you?
Well, that certainly defines, I guess that's my definition of Richard Nixon, too. They were all out to get him. You know, he's out there fighting the good fight all the time, and the media just decides to pick up the negative stuff. But I hate to do the report card kind of thing, but how would you rate the CNBC moderators during the debate? Sometimes I thought the questions were absolutely fair. Sometimes I thought some of the language was a bit over the top.
It turned into, it was a little snarky at times, I agree with you. I didn't think they did that great. The CNN debate, the Democratic debate, I thought was pretty good. I thought it was mostly about issues and not too much about gotcha. So in that respect, maybe there was a point. But this is Reince Priebus. This is, the debates are arranged by the party. They're the ones who select the partners, as they're called, the people who set it up and do the moderation. If they want to have Rush Limbaugh moderate a debate, have Rush Limbaugh moderate a debate.
Was it Ted Cruz or somebody who said that the next panel to moderate a Republican debate should be Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, and Mark Levin, right?
And it ought to be pretty interesting, don't you think? Because those people are going to be, they're not going to be that easy. I mean, it's going to be a different set of questions you're going to hear, but I think there'll be a few gotchas in there, too.
Well, remember the first debate with Megyn Kelly? I mean, everybody said, oh, Fox News is going to go easy on the Republicans. Megyn Kelly, I thought, gave one of the best performances by a debate moderator this year, if not the best.
And what did she get for it?
Yeah, well, she got great ratings, that's for sure.
She did get great ratings, but it is the style of somebody like a Donald Trump to respond in that vein in which he did against Megyn Kelly. That's what he does. And so I think other candidates playing off that saw this as the way to respond to questions, some of which they really didn't want to answer.
I talk to a lot of people all the time about the debates, and they say, oh, I don't want to watch another one. I've seen it already. But it seems like, to me, each time we've seen a debate, we've either seen a new, not so much a front runner, but a new star of the debate. I think, you know, after the first debate, we said John Kasich looked good. After the second debate, we thought it was Carly Fiorina. I thought Rubio, Cruz, and Christie all were very good at the last one. Do you see the same thing? Do you have a moving scorecard each time these guys and gal debate?
Absolutely. It's what we do. We sit there we love this stuff. And it is interesting to see how it then plays out in the polls that succeed that. Now, Hillary Clinton, everybody agreed, had a tremendous performance in her debate and then did well in front of the Benghazi committee. And the polls now all seem to reflect that. The latest Wall Street Journal poll has her up 2-1 over Bernie Sanders. The last time Marco Rubio did well in the Republican debate, and he is now, I guess, number three in New Hampshire. Ted Cruz, everybody thought did well. He didn't get the bounce. So I guess it depends. I'm not sure Ted Cruz came across as likable as Marco Rubio, and that has some things to do with it, too. But the other thing we have to look at is, as you see these polls, it's all really, really fluid, don't you think? People are still making up their minds, I think, particularly on the Republican side.
Well, 4 years ago at this time, the same polls that show Carson and Donald Trump battling out for the lead, Herman Cain was a front runner 4 years ago at this time. You know, we're mentioning all these candidates. We're mentioning Trump and Carson and Cruz and Rubio and Christie. The one guy we haven't mentioned, and I'm interested in your perspective on this because to me it's fascinating, is whatever happened to Jeb Bush?
Yeah, whatever happened to Jeb Bush? Isn't the helium going out of that balloon pretty fast? I don't see how he recovers, to tell you the truth. Once the donors start really asking questions and moving elsewhere, as we've seen Marco Rubio picking up some major league support, it's really hard to get it back on track. You know, the comeback kid stories are, you know, remarkable and amazing, don't you think? Because they don't happen that often.
Bush said that when I see something going wrong, I retool and refix it. But I think that each succeeding debate, he's looked weaker and weaker. And sure, Carson and Trump are the headlines. But, I mean, you know, you're 4,800 miles away from Washington. God bless you. But I'm just wondering how you see it all the way out there. Because here it's just, you know, I just shake my head. I mean, look, nobody saw this anti-establishment mood the way it's come about. But somehow I thought that Bush would be able to surpass it. And he just seems to be sinking. And I thought that attack he gave on Marco Rubio, the debate, seemed forced and almost desperate.
And played right into Marco Rubio's wheelhouse. He was absolutely ready for it. And so the moment that Jeb Bush was trying to score became a moment for Marco Rubio. And, you know, it's interesting. Like Scott Walker, Jeb Bush set up a big national campaign organization, a big expensive campaign organization. He's had to scale back. And once you start laying off staff, once you say, you know, we're going to go all in on New Hampshire and, you know, really focus there, and we don't really care so much how we do in Iowa. Once you start reducing people's pay, he's now using John McCain as his example of, you know, in 2008, John McCain was carrying his own bag, and he made the comeback to run against get the Republican nomination and should have been president. But again, these stories don't happen that often, and I don't see that Jeb Bush has the charisma. Do you think the debates? He's just not a very good debater, don't you think?
No, I clearly agree. I mean, I think he's very thoughtful. I think he's been thinking about these issues for years, but he just seems to be so uncomfortable. And the thought of him attacking, even when he was attacking Rubio, I thought there was a pain, somehow a tremendous discomfort. Anyway, we have two debates next week. We have one on Tuesday. We have a Democratic one the following Saturday. I mean, you know, about 5 days later on Saturday the 14th. What are you going to be looking for?
I'm going to be looking to see what Bernie Sanders does. Does he come out swinging? Again, that doesn't seem to be in his character. It's not the kind of campaign he's run thus far, but he's got to do something because his numbers are, you know, he's got that impassioned base. I don't think that's going to go away. But right now, you know, what's he playing for? A good slot to speak at the convention?
Yeah, that's a good point, because it, almost like with Jeb Bush, if Bernie Sanders starts attacking Hillary Clinton, it would sound forced and not in everything that Bernie Sanders says he's not.
And if she can continue. Now, again, the bad mistakes that she has made in her career have all been when it looked like she was cruising along with no problem. So, you know, it ain't over until it's over, to quote the great Yogi Berra. But and she's been criticized for being risk averse. But, you know, right now it looks like it's hers to lose.
Anything you'd be looking for in next Tuesday's Republican debate?
Again, it's Jeb Bush's, it might be his last moment. If he does not have a better performance, he doesn't have to be the, you know, quote unquote winner, but he has to have a better performance. He's got to steady the ship. Otherwise, I think it's going to flounder. And because of its expense, because it's weighed down by all of those staffers, it could go down pretty quickly, like Scott Walker's did.
Neal Conan is the former host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. He's currently a news analyst for Hawaii Public Radio while running a macadamia nut farm on the Big Island. And we get him the first show of every month. Neal, it's great talking to you again.
Ken, always good to talk to you.
Donald Trump may have lost his lead in the national polls, and he no longer seems to dominate the debates. But one thing is for certain. He is hosting Saturday Night Live this weekend. In its 40-year history, Saturday Night Live has invited politicians of both parties to come on the show and be a good sport. Often they are asked to make fun of themselves. Sometimes the skits work, sometimes they don't, but they are always talked about. And you know how Donald Trump hates when people talk about him. Bill Horner is a political science professor at the University of Missouri and currently working on a book about Saturday Night Live and the presidential election of 1976. Nicole Hemmer is a contributing editor at U.S. News & World Report and a research associate at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Nicole and Bill, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nicole, are you happy to be here? You didn't mention that you were happy to be here.
I am, in fact, happy to be here.
I just wasn't sure. Okay. Bill, let me start with you. That 1976 election featured President Gerald Ford and Democratic challenger Jimmy Carter. When I think of Saturday Night Live and Jerry Ford, I think of how Chevy Chase portrayed him as a bumbling, fumbling, incompetent goofball. Here's a piece of tape from 1975.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans, I have called upon the networks tonight to make two pressing issues clear to the American public. Number one, the possible default of New York City. And number one, my stand on the Ronald Reagan announcement. The point is, do I really know what the issue is? Relevant, irrelevant, fault, default, these are just hard words. Which brings me to my first point. Let's take a look at the recent popularity polls, shall we? Oops, right. Out, no problem.
You know, what I love about that so much is that I'm not seeing it. I'm listening to it. But believe me, I can see it watching Chevy Chase fall down and collapse and make a fool of himself. And Bill, my question actually is, there is a question to all this. Do you think the voters may have seen Ford that way as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they did. I think the role that SNL played in that whole, you know, people's perception of Ford was to reinforce something that was already in you know, it was in coverage of Ford. It was, yeah, Tom Brokaw interviewed, you know, Tom Brokaw was the White House correspondent at the time for NBC, and he interviewed Ford and asked him, and he sort of hemmed and hawed and said, it's an awkward question, but, you know, Mr. President, people feel that there are people who feel you're not smart enough to be president. What is your response to that? And so there was this perception that started with, you know, Nixon used to make fun of him, Johnson used to make fun of him. There was this idea that he wasn't very bright. And then he had the accident falling down the stairs in Austria. And so, you know, SNL parodied all that and magnified it and made it, you know, sort of the singular way that a lot of people came to see Ford.
I mean, there was so many. I mean, first of all, the Ford-Carter election was so close. There was the pardon of Richard Nixon. There was the debate gaffes. There were so many things that could have turned the election. And I just wonder if maybe enough people saw the bumbling Gerald Ford on a Saturday Night Live that could have swayed the election as well.
Well, so this is the great question, right? And you know, political scientists love data, and there's not great data on this. Nobody asked the right questions about SNL and, you know, and the election during the, at the time, and the kinds of questions that get asked now for sure. So it's hard to say with real certainty, but the election was very close. It was still a relatively unique thing for 18-year-olds to vote, and they were a prime part of the SNL demographic. It is certainly true that at the time, people like Ron Nessen, who was Ford's press secretary and appeared on SNL in 76, hosted SNL in 76, and Chevy Chase and others that were involved with either with the show or with the campaign thought that it made a difference in the election. And Ron Nessen wrote about that in his autobiography, in fact.
It certainly had a role to play. I think that one of the points that that Bill really hits on here is that SNL is most effective in confirming a narrative that's already out there and then making it a bigger part of how people perceive a politician. And I think that was definitely the case with Ford. And I think his point about Nessen is important, too, that the Ford administration was so aware of the effect that the Saturday Night Live portrayals were having on his image more broadly that they tried to find a way to respond to it. And you see something very different than you would see today. Gerald Ford was a little wary of going on and participating himself. So he sends his press secretary, Nessen, to do it. And then he does little filmed bits as part of the Saturday Night Live episode. So you begin to see very early on politicians trying to wrest back control. I don't think it was terribly effective, but I think politicians have gotten smarter about it since.
I mean, the irony is that Ford was a star athlete at the University of Michigan, and the thought of him as a bumbling, falling down kind of guy, of course, he did fall down, as Bill pointed out, but, I mean, he was a star athlete. It just seems kind of ironic that he of all presidents, would be seen as clumsy and awkward, things like that.
Right, and he was smart and he was experienced, but this public image comes to overshadow that.
The idea that politicians go on comedy programs to show they can take a joke is not especially new. I think many of us who are old enough will never forget the time Richard Nixon, who was running for president, appeared on Laugh-In in 1968.
Sock it to me?
I mean, that was pretty monumental back then. The thought of Richard Nixon doing comedy, actually the thought of today of Richard Nixon doing comedy is pretty bizarre, but I would make the case that SNL may not be as edgy as it once was, but you know, we all watched that fake Democratic debate on the program a few weeks ago, and we all laughed at Larry David doing Bernie Sanders, but both of you, I'm wondering what you thought about Alec Baldwin doing Jim Webb.
Excuse me, it's me, Jim Webb, your future president. I was promised I'd get time, and I've had no time. Where's my time? Come on, Anderson, lob one at me. Give Jimmy W. his shot and watch him soar.
Okay, Senator, sure. Here's a question. You're the only Democrat up here with an A rating from the NRA. Want to tell us why?
Pass.
Nicole, what did the viewers learn about Jim Webb from that little bit there?
Well, I think what they learned is that his policies themselves were laughably out of step with the rest of the Democratic Party. This highlights one of the powers of a program like SNL. People already had a pretty good idea of who Bernie Sanders was. They didn't have a good sense of Jim Webb. And SNL then had the power to define him more strongly in the voters' imagination or in the audience's imagination. And what they chose to do is they chose to take Jim Webb's actual positions and play them for laugh lines.
But of course, obviously he was portrayed negatively. I'm not sure if that's the reason he dropped out of the race shortly afterwards. But obviously, I mean, it not only pointed out that he was endorsed by the NRA, which is not a popular position among Democrats, but also we reminded everybody that all he seemed to do in that debate was to whine about lack of time.
Right. And I think the thing that worked to his disadvantage, and, you would never get him to admit that SNL is what forced him to drop out of the race.
Yeah.
But what that graphically pointed out was that nobody knew who he was. Right. And so the impression that most people had of him was what they saw on SNL.
And I would tie it back to the Tina Fey, Sarah Palin parody back in the 2008 campaign when Tina Fey would appear and she would actually use Sarah Palin's actual words as part of her skit and play those for laugh lines. And I think that when you can blend reality and humor that way, that's even more powerful.
Let me play a little bit of that Tina Fey impersonation.
Senator McCain shut down his campaign this week in order to deal with the economic crisis. What's your opinion of this potential $700 billion bailout?
Like every American I'm speaking with, we are ill about this. We're saying, hey, why bail out Fannie and Freddie and not me? But ultimately, what the bailout does is help those that are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, to help... it's got to be all about job creation, too. Also, to shoring up our economy and putting Fannie and Freddie back on the right track. And so health care reform and reducing taxes and reining in spending, because Barack Obama, we've got to accompany tax reduction and tax relief for Americans. Also, having a dollar value meal at restaurants, that's going to help. But one in five jobs being created today under the umbrella of job creation, that, you know, also...
That was devastating, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And, you know, that's an interesting situation. And that was devastating for Sarah Palin. You know, you can't argue that that had a real impact on the outcome of that election. That was not a particularly close election, and it was not going to be affected by SNL. But what it really did was it has had a long-term, probably forever, impact on Sarah Palin's ability to be taken seriously as a politician by all but, you know, a small percentage of the population. And so it was very damaging to her personally.
Well, you know, Sarah Palin, she never said that she could see Russia from her window, but Tina Fey, as Sarah Palin, said it, and so we all think that the real Palin did say it. I think, if nothing else, I think that indicates SNL can be a powerful weapon of satire.
Absolutely, and that it can stick in the public imagination. But again, it can only stick with the public if it's reinforcing something that people already are open to, right? It has to resonate with people. You can't just make up a characteristic out of whole cloth.
Sometimes, you know, SNL will bring on a real politician in to set the record straight. And I think of Dana Carvey, who would always, you know, butcher George H.W. Bush's way of talking, and Bush himself had fun with it.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And they had Dana Carvey at the White House. And, you know, it's funny because Carvey was always worried about, he knew of Bush's sort of admiration for his impression of him. And he always wondered if they were paying attention to the things he was actually saying as Bush, because, you know, he felt like it was sort of a fairly negative portrayal. But they had Carvey appear at the White House, and then when Bush left the White House, he appeared on SNL. He didn't appear as president, but he did appear after the fact. And Bush was somebody who was able to see the humor in it and sort of try and play along with the joke as opposed to fighting the joke.
Let me play a little bit of that tape.
A not guy do it, and a not guy. I say, not guy. What? Well, I was doing my not guy.
President Bush is still on the hookup, and he wants to say something.
He's here now?
Yeah, should I put him through?
All right, put him in.
Dana, George Bush here. I'm watching you do your impression of me, and I gotta say, it's nothing like me. Bears no resemblance. It's bad. It's bad.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I think it's a fair impression.
Don't see it.
You don't?
It's totally exaggerated. Not me, those crazy hand gestures. The pointing thing, I don't do them. And also, na-ga-da, never said it. In all my years of government service, I never once said na-ga-da.
That was fun.
Yes.
And it shows the importance of getting in there and proving that you're in on the joke. I think that's something that his son, George W. Bush, caught on to pretty quickly as well. So he goes on to Saturday Night Live and he plays along in a way that Al Gore, who was a little more buttoned up and already had that image of being a bit stiff, when he was invited on to Saturday Night Live, he sent his people in to first vet the script and showed a kind of stiffness that reinforced the parody that SNL was putting forward, something that George W. Bush managed to sidestep.
Right, Gore's personality was in a lockbox, right?
Yes.
You know, Donald Trump is going to host on Saturday, and I'm sure that many of the jokes will be about his hair or his self-importance. But in some ways, he's been making fun of that all along on the campaign trail. So is there anything that could possibly happen that could possibly embarrass Donald Trump?
I think he's probably beyond embarrassment, but he's also an entertainer rather than a politician.
I agree. I think he is probably beyond embarrassment. What will be interesting to know, and what we probably won't know till after the fact, is how involved he was with the, you know, with the actual writing of the script. You know, the typical SNL guest host is there for the week and works on it, which was not the case with Nesson when he hosted in 1976. He showed up sort of, you know, the day before and paid the price for doing that. So, you know, what I don't know at this point is how involved Trump has been. You know, what will be interesting to see, because there are lots of groups that are protesting his appearance on the show, particularly, you know, Hispanic groups are very upset about the fact that he's doing this. And it will be interesting to see if they have any material that deals with that in the show and how he comes off in that material.
You know, I was thinking of, as we were talking, I was thinking of Rudy Giuliani when he was on the program and he came in drag. Now, I thought it was gutsy and it was funny, but I'm not convinced it was a smart idea.
No, I don't think it was. And I think that they get wrapped up in the, you know, the back behind the scenes sometimes. I think people get wrapped up in what's going on behind the scenes and the camaraderie, or what they think is camaraderie with the cast. And they go out and they do it, and it's something they regret.
Nicole, I mean, you talked about the possibility or the likelihood that Donald Trump is incapable of embarrassing himself, but are there risks for him?
There don't seem to be risks for him. He seems to operate outside of the normal parameters of politics. I suppose that if people start poking around this topic of immigration, but as we've seen, he's been able to say incredibly incendiary things about immigrants and about Hispanics without paying a price in the polls. So it's hard to imagine what exactly a fail for Donald Trump would look like, at least in the eyes of the electorate that's currently supporting him.
Everybody likes to say that Saturday Night Live no longer is as clever as it used to be. It certainly doesn't have the bite that Jon Stewart had. But I guess they still play a role of affecting voters' views of candidates, don't you think?
Absolutely. They have a much broader audience, I think, still than even really popular shows like John Oliver's show, which is cordoned away over on HBO. So I think that they still have a mass power, but I also think that part of their power comes from the fact that they're not expected to be cutting edge. That if Saturday Night Live can see the foibles and can nail the joke, then it must be something that's self-evident, as in the case with Webb, that his irrelevance was the punchline. And if Saturday Night Live can see that, then it must be a pretty obvious thing.
Nicole Hemmer is a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report and a research associate at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Bill Horner is a political science professor at the University of Missouri and currently working on a book co-authored with his wife, Heather Carver, called I'm Gerald Ford and You're Not, Saturday Night Live and the Presidential Election of 1976. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks so much. This was fun.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
As it turns out, the subject of presidential appearances on Saturday Night Live was also the focus of our last trivia question, which, as you may remember, was read by my mom.
Who was the first incumbent president to appear on Saturday Night Live?
I love her voice. The answer is Gerald Ford. Long impersonated by Chevy Chase, the real President Ford appeared on the program on April 17th, 1976.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night.
And the randomly selected winner is Frank Kennedy of Ardmore, Pennsylvania. He gets the coveted political junkie button. And we have a Scuttlebutton puzzle winner as well. Scuttlebutton, if you don't already know, is that waste of time contest where I post a bunch of buttons in a vertical line, and your job is to take a word or concept from each button and come up with a familiar saying or slogan people from Earth would recognize. Our last puzzle was a toughie, and very few got it. Sometimes the answers are ridiculously easy. This one was not. The first button was a Charlie Sandman for governor of New Jersey, and it was the big letters, Vote the F line. Then there was a Win with West button with a big W. Finally, a button that read D, Clerk Superior Court. In my calculation, when you combine F and W and D Clerk, you get F.W. de Klerk, who was South Africa's last president under apartheid. Who says you don't learn things in Scuttlebutton? Anyway, the winner is Michael Hopps of Baxter, Minnesota. As always, you can find our political columns, trivia questions, Scuttlebutton puzzles, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. In 1965, John Lindsay, a liberal Republican congressman from Manhattan's East Side, announced his candidacy for mayor of New York. By anyone's definition, New York City was in big trouble in 1965. Crime, drugs, filth. Lots of problems. 20 years of Democratic mayors. Lindsay was tall, handsome, and charismatic. Plus, he had Ethel Merman on his side.
Dirty streets, dirty air, dirty deals they pretend are in there. In the past, we've been stuck. Now at last, we're in luck. What John D. Lindsay says he'll do, he'll do. And with Lindsay, it's coming up roses for me and for you.
Lindsay's main opponent was Abraham Beam, the city controller. Lindsay said Beam was beholden to the Democratic bosses, but on many issues, the two were not far apart. One person stood way apart from the Democratic and Republican candidates. William F. Buckley Jr. was the 39-year-old editor of the National Review, a conservative magazine that strongly supported Goldwater the year before. Buckley, who didn't even live in the city, was the candidate of the Conservative Party, formed a few years earlier to battle the so-called liberal takeover of the GOP by Nelson Rockefeller, Jacob Javits, and others like them. Buckley had no intention of winning. He wanted to have fun. As with this one-liner when he addressed the Overseas Press Club.
And thank you, the Overseas Press Club. I sometimes wish all the press were overseas.
That election was 50 years ago this week. Al Felsenberg is a staffer on the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress. He was previously the spokesperson for the 9/11 Commission, served as New Jersey's Assistant Secretary of State under Governor Thomas Kane. He also teaches at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's written many books, and he's writing right now, I don't know about this very second, but he's writing a biography of Bill Buckley. Al, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Ken.
Al, put down your pen, stop writing the biography, because I need to talk to you for The Political Junkie.
Okay, it's my lunch hour.
Yeah. You know, I could have easily made John Lindsay the focus of this week in political history. I mean, after all, he won and Buckley lost, but Buckley's campaign made for a great story, didn't it?
Both did. I like to tell my students that Lindsay showed you could lose by winning, and Buckley showed you could win by losing. They had different targets. Buckley was not out to be president of the United States, which John Lindsay was. When John Lindsay ran for re-election to Congress in the old New York silk stocking district, the slogan was, the district's pride, the nation's hope. Tells you a little bit about his ambitions. Note the word hope, and note what liberals have used the word hope lately. Buckley was very different. We can talk about that as we go, but you could do a show on John Lindsay. I did an article on him. I called it Liberalism Has Consequences. And if you want to look at a paradigm of how not perhaps to run an urban city, the Lindsay years really shine.
I mean, well, look, Buckley knew he was going to lose, and he knew he was going to finish in third place. And New York City is hardly the hotbed of conservative voters, so why did he run?
Well, first of all, you point out Goldwater was defeated overwhelmingly. For 20 years or so, the conservatives have said that there was just this unorganized conservative majority out there, and if they could just kind of get together and realign the parties and have a party under their own, conservative Republicans and conservative Democrats would actually elect one of their own and repeal a good deal of what happened with the New Deal and the Fair Deal and the Great Society and what you want. Well, they had their chance in 1964. And as James Reston pointed out, to be careful what you ask for. You've got an overwhelmingly overwhelming defeat. Goldwater carried Arizona, where he was almost in jeopardy of losing it, and five southern states. And those wins were attributable to his opposition to the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. Buckley was not one to give up. First of all, conservatives needed a shot in the arm. He was convinced other factors were at work. The nation was not going to have three presidents in 1 year. Kennedy sadly assassinated Johnson, putting his stamp on the White House, and then, of course, repudiated by the Republicans. That was too much change, too fast. It wasn't going to happen. But conservatives needed a shot in the arm. The power structure had come together in this municipal election to elect a Republican Kennedy lookalike, some of the people called him. And they can do that. They can not only save the country from Goldwaterism, but they can take over the whole country.
Al, I get your how you feel, how you see John Lindsay coming into power there. But I want to talk more about Bill Buckley. What kind of policies was he proposing?
He was trying to do a Goldwater kind of campaign in the most liberal city in America. A man running for mayor of New York wants to repeal rent control. Unheard of. A man running in the most liberal city in the world, where the biggest issue about education before he came along was whether we should provide aid to private parochial schools and school prayer. These were the issues, not why is Johnny not reading? Busing was coming in. Schools were being very, very crowded. Parochial families or families that wanted to send their children to parochial school were being crushed financially. No assistance for them. They were called racist bigots if they wanted to continue to have a Catholic education a year or two after the courts had banned prayer. He's talking about what we now would recognize as school prayer, as school vouchers, as school choice.
What was his relationship like with the press? I mean, we know that Republican candidates, and we saw this in the recent CNBC debate, they love to talk about media bias. Well, how did Buckley and the press get along?
Quite well, surprisingly. The press had very little respect for his ideas, but they have great respect for him on two or three levels. You just said, here was a man who spoke in full paragraphs, perfect English. He was a man who answered questions. He ran away from spin. He exposed the hypocrisy of Lindsay and Beam. He was once asked after the Democratic primary. Lindsay got in very early and locked down the Republican line and the Liberal Party line, which we can come back to very early. Democrats had a bloodbath of a primary, and A. Beam was nominated. They asked John Lindsay what he saw as the main difference between his opponents. The line was timeless. It was, Mr. Lindsay is a tall man. Mr. Beam is a short man. So what we have here is a tall liberal running against a short liberal. So I would say to you that the differences between them are much more biological than ideological. Now, you imagine sitting there with your spiral notebook trying to take this down. They expected to hear a long discourse. What they got was a lesson in biology.
I want to play two pieces of tape from an appearance the three candidates made on Meet the Press back in the fall of 65. Asked if he would get satisfied. We were talking about whether he wanted, if he was running to get Lindsay defeated. And he was asked if he would get satisfaction if he was responsible for Lindsay's defeat. This is what he said.
Mr. Buckley, will you draw any solace from the defeat of Mr. Lindsay?
No, here's what I will draw solace from, that for the first time there will have been demonstrated that there is in New York sufficient people to embolden those legislators in Albany or in City Hall or in Washington who want to vote conservative but feel that if they do so, they're going to come back and be executed by the liberal machines that dominate these two gentlemen. I want them to surface. They can only do so by voting for me, so that the whole nature of politics in New York State will change, so that they will know that there are people there who will support them in the coming elections.
And he also, I'm sorry about the tape. This is a not great quality tape. But he also, Lawrence Spivak, the moderator, wanted to know why New Yorkers should vote for him when he didn't even live in New York. This is his answer to that.
People do seem to believe that something is wrong in New York, something is critically wrong in New York, and seem to be dissatisfied with the performance of people who have boasted of their professional qualifications. As regards the technical matter of my residency in New York, I face no problems that Bobby Kennedy didn't face. I haven't heard many complaints about his performance since being elected senator from New York, and my ties to New York are at least as old as his.
Notice how he's using this against the Democrats, who thought this was an outrage. He's using this against Lindsey, and he's pointing out, look, you spend most of your time working in Washington. I'm running a magazine here. I'm as much a New Yorker as you are. And it worked very, very well. They tried to use this against him.
Buckley finished with 13% of the vote, and Lindsey won despite Buckley's best efforts. Was his candidacy worth it? Was it good for conservatives?
Well, let's see. There was a young man out in California who was paying attention to all of this. His name was Ronald Reagan. And in California at the time, in Orange County in Southern California, remember, Goldwater had beat Rockefeller very handily in the very narrowly, but he did win. So there was a conservative base in California.
In the California primary of 64, right?
64. And 1965, when Buckley's running for mayor, Reagan's paying attention. Reagan is doing a Hillary Clinton listening tour around the state of California. He's adopting many of Buckley's ideas. And you have 3 years in a row. You have the Goldwater defeat. You have Buckley's symbolic, he called it a paradigmatic campaign, an educational campaign, showing that if conservatives can get 13% of the vote in New York, they can do well elsewhere. And he made this point many, many times. So, yes, it had an impact for Reagan. It had an impact for conservatives that came later. I mentioned Jack Kemp earlier. And I think, above all, it created the long march for conservatives to finally not only take over their party, which they had done in 1964, but to take over the country.
Al Felsenberg is a staffer on the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress, and he's writing a biography of Bill Buckley. Al, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you.
It was 50 years ago this week when John Lindsay, Abraham Beam, and William F. Buckley Jr. all ran for mayor of New York City. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Up to you.